good afternoon and welcome everyone to today's Internet Web Seminar entitled Nanotechnology, Implications, and Applications. This web seminar is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. I'm Dr. Sarah Wilkinson. I'm the Research Translation Coordinator with the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program, and I'll be the moderator for today's session. We'll get started in just a few minutes, but while we're waiting for a few more folks to log on, I'd like to cover some housekeeping items. When you register, you are directed to the seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session, as well as short bio sketches of the presenters. And the presenters' email addresses are hot links on that page in case you have any questions after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, your phones were placed on mute when you join the call. We will have question and answer sessions, at which point you can take your phone off mute. We ask that phone participants keep their phones on mute during the Q&A session unless you are asking a question. To unmute your phone during the Q&A session, you will need to dial *7. You may also need to press your phone's mute button if you previously put yourself on mute. After you ask your question, please place your phone back on mute by pressing *6 or by using your phone's mute button. Once again, that's *6 to mute and *7 to unmute. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music that can be distracting to the call. By now, those of you participating via the phone line should have the presentation open and should be on slide 1. All of those participating via the internet should have clicked the Go To Session icon near the bottom of the page and should also be on slide 1 of the presentation. As explained on the next slide, slide 2, the main page contains the slides, above which you will find navigation icons. Internet participants may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slides and need not wait until the Q&A period to submit a question. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the Q&A session. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the difficulties you are encountering. Please include your telephone number where you can be reached, and we will try to help you troubleshoot the problem. The presenter will be announcing the number of the slide to which he is moving. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. At the end of the presentations, we will walk you through our links page where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form, and we ask that you consider filling that form out. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. The seminars are typically placed in the archive with the soundtrack. In the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Past web seminars are available on the CLUIN website and are also accessible via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Programs, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information, or CLUIN, archive. With that, we are ready to start this session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute with *6, and again, please do not put us on hold. Our first presenter for today is Dr. Ian Kennedy. Dr. Kennedy joined the Department of Mechanical and Aeronautical Engineering at the University of California, Davis in 1986 after a period as a research staff member at Princeton University and several years at the Aeronautical Research Laboratories in Australia. He has developed a major aerosol research facility in the University of California, Davis, in which efforts are directed at varied problems related to ultrafine particle synthesis and applications in technology. Funding has been obtained from NSF, NASA, AFSOSR, the California Air Resources Board, the Health Effects Institute, a consortium that includes the US EPA and the engine industry, and NIEHS. The research in his laboratory includes studies of nanoscale particulate emissions from combustion systems, including engines. A major thrust of Dr. Kennedy's efforts is directed towards understanding the impact of ultrafine aerosol particles on human health. This interest is pursued via extensive multidisciplinary collaboration with colleagues in environmental toxicology, land, air, water resources, veterinary medicine, chemistry, and civil and environmental engineering. He is also involved in applying nanoscale particles to detection technologies in biology and biophotonics, such as using nanoscale phosphors as labels of biomolecules. This work involves collaborative research with colleagues in the departments of entomology, internal medicine, and land, air, water resources. Today, Dr. Kennedy will be telling us a little bit about the risks of health with exposure to metal nanoparticles, and we look forward to hearing your talk. Thank you, Dr. Kennedy.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you to everybody who is listening in today, and we will start with slide number 3, which is my introduction. The title here, Risk Exposure to Metal Nanoparticles, indicates I'm focusing on a particular category of nanomaterials, that is, metals and metal oxides. My subtitle, Engineering for Toxicology, is a little abstract, but by that I intend to convey the idea that engineers have something to offer toxicologists in terms of developing new ways, new methods of understanding the health risks of nanomaterials and developing methods for answering some of those questions. So engineers have a role to play in all of this, not just in understanding the formation mechanisms of nanomaterials, but also working with toxicologists to look at those health aspects. Let's move to slide number 4, please. Nanomaterials are materials less than 100 nanometers in dimension with new properties, properties that are not evident in the bulk phase materials. Some of these new properties give rise to functionalities that are the reason that we're interested in developing new nanomaterials. Most nanomaterials could be classified either into carbonaceous form, that is carbon nanotubes and fullerenes, or into metal-based materials. There's a lot of work going on looking at the health effects of carbon-based nanomaterials, but I am not going to cover that today. I'm just going to focus on metals and in particular the metal oxides, which are widely used, widely applied, and raise significant concerns about health effects. Some of the applications are listed here, and they include things like gas sensors, which people are developing with nanoscale materials that offer greater sensitivity. We ourselves here at Davis are using them as a platform for biosensing to attach antibodies and do immunoassays on the top of nanoparticles. Applications include use for solar energy production, use in medicine for cancer therapy using hypothermia that involves heating of nanomaterials which are attached to tumors in the body, heating by high-frequency magnetic fields which then ablate or destroy the tumor. They can be used for MRI contrast agents. Nanoscale iron oxide particles are used for magnetic resonance imaging contrast. Zero valent iron is being used as a cleanup material for removing fluorinated hydrocarbons, for example, in contaminated water. Catalysts are a very common application for nanomaterials, including ceria, which I will mention a little later on. Many of us may have used nanomaterials in commercial products like sunblock. Zinc oxide is being used fairly widely as a sunblock. It has been around a long time, of course, but these days the nanoscale zinc oxide is being used in sunblock material and is thought to be, in fact, environmentally more benign, particularly when it's used, people are using it on coral reefs, where there's been research showing that the conventional chemical sunblock agent is having an effect on the health of corals and also on tropical fish. So zinc oxide is an alternative, and that may or may not actually get through our skin into our body. And now silver is being widely used in commercial or consumer products as a bactericide, so an agent which will reduce odor in socks and clothing, etc. So that one is actually being used fairly commonly. So those are just a few of the applications of these metal oxide nanoparticles. You'll see at the top of the slide I call these engineered metal oxide nanoparticles, and that is to differentiate them from nanomaterials which are unintentionally produced. So the stuff that comes out of engines, for example, we have been exposed to for about 100 years or so, and that is an example of an unintentionally manufactured nanomaterial. The concern that we have these days is not only the unintentionally made stuff, but the intentionally engineered nanomaterials, which are creating new shapes and morphologies and compositions that lead to concerns about the potential health effects for us and for the environment. Let's move to slide number 5. So one of the things that concerns people about these materials is the wide range of compositions that are possible, and in addition to that, we have also a wide range of new shapes or morphologies. Zinc oxide is a very good example of that. Zinc oxide can be produced in a wide range of morphologies, and just a few are indicated here. These morphologies can, in the case of zinc oxide, encompass shapes like long wires, spirals, belts. These are called nanobelts. So the zinc oxide can be produced with different synthesis conditions in these wide range of shapes or morphologies. And that raises concern about how these shapes may interact with living systems. For example, might these long wires behave something like asbestos? There is some indication that carbon nanotubes might do that. That may also be a concern for some of these metal oxide morphologies. So, in addition to the composition, we have this additional concern that we need to look at, which is the morphology of the material. Let's go to slide number 6. Nanomaterials have been around for a long time, of course. We have been producing unintentionally nanomaterials for millennia. From the time that humans first discovered fire, we have been exposed to those. And in fact, that continues to be a major source of exposure in indoor cooking. Fuels burned indoors may produce significant amounts of hazardous ultrafine or nanoscale materials. More recently, I mentioned vehicles, and that is a major source that we have looked at for many years of unintentionally manufactured particles, but the engineered particles produced by a wide range of different methods. Solution-based methods using wet chemistry is a common approach, but tends not to be scalable very well to high production rates. Often the gas phase methods are more amenable to high scale or high rates of production, and they would include things like laser-assisted methods using decomposition of a precursor, the kinds of technologies that have been used in CVD or chemical vapor deposition and aerosol methods, which have been used to produce bulk amounts of nanoscale materials like titania and silica for many years. So there are methods out there for producing significant quantities of some of the basic metal oxides, and those things are being used these days for the common materials like titania and silica. Let's go to slide number 7. Here's an example of just one of those methods. This is a flame synthesis, a high temperature aerosol process that produces zinc oxide whiskers, those long, skinny fibers of zinc oxide, which can be used for a variety of applications. Zinc oxide is one of the more interesting materials here because it has such a wide range of properties. It's a semiconductor material. It is piezoelectric, meaning that it can be used to apply forces or detect forces. It has an optical absorption. It has a range of different interesting properties. And so zinc oxide is one that I keep coming back to during the talk for various reasons, because of its toxicity and also its interesting properties. Let's go to slide number 8. So here again, aerosol synthesis leads to not only scalability, which means high production rates, can also lead to a lot of different morphologies. And when we're producing these things in industrial scale, we may lead to occupational exposures, which may be a very significant potential route for exposure to nanomaterials in the workplace. Let's go to slide number 9. So the risk from these materials is the combination of exposure and toxicity. If they're not toxic, then it doesn't matter how much we're exposed to. On the other hand, if they are toxic and there is no exposure, again, the risk is not great. So it's that combination that's important. The routes for exposure can be either in occupational settings or through environmental exposures. And the route of exposure can be either inhalation, ingestion, or via the dermal route through our skin. Most of my work has been concerned with inhalation because the roots of my research lay in exposure to ambient particles generated by vehicles. mobile sources, typically, and so inhalation has been the most, has been the major exposure route that we've been concerned with. Typically, inhalation would be most important during an occupational exposure where people were not adopting and following appropriate industrial hygiene measures, and workers might get exposed in unregulated or poorly regulated and controlled workplaces. An environmental exposure to engineered nanomaterials might incur probably more likely through ingestion or the dermal route, so we may get exposed to these materials if they end up in the environment and through that in our food chain and ultimately consumed by us in some food product. Or if we're applying these materials as cosmetics or sunblock, we may be exposed through the dermal route. Typically, the skin is a pretty good barrier to anything passing through it, but if the skin is damaged, if there is sun damage before application of materials, or there's some skin disease, that barrier does break down, and there is evidence that things like zinc oxide may be taken up through sun-damaged skin and end up through the rest of the body. It appears not to be the case for healthy skin. That is a pretty effective barrier to uptake of these materials. If they do end up in the environment, then there is the question of what we call fate and transport. Do these materials persist as nanomaterials in the environment, or are they scavenged by other solid materials like minerals in the water and the soil? Do they stick to those things? And that seems fairly likely that they will be scavenged by larger materials and will be stuck to them. They may not persist as individual nanoparticles for very long. Can they be transformed in the environment? And dissolution may happen in lower pH environments with humic acid in water. They may therefore dissolve, or they may change oxidation state, which may change their surface charge and some of their properties and behavior. So ultimately, we want to look at all of those things and their toxicity and eventually uptake in living systems, which would include aquatic plants, fish, things that may contribute to our food, uptake by cells at the cellular level, and then what effect do those materials have on living systems like cells? Are they toxic? What are the suitable measures of toxicity? And what determines the toxicity? Is it simply size? Is it composition, morphology, some of those other issues? And that is a really significant problem these days in this area because we have so many variables, it's very hard to determine what the likely toxicity is of new materials as we develop them. We need a good framework for assessing toxicity, and that is occupying a lot of attention by people all around the world who are looking at nanomaterial toxicity, trying to come up with a rational way of predicting what toxicity might be for current and new materials. So if we move to slide number 10, I'm going to describe some of the things that we have done at Davis which addresses some of those issues that I just mentioned. We have, over the years, looked at a wide variety of metal oxide materials and applied a number of different techniques for looking at their toxicity, both in vivo and in vitro assays, working in collaboration with our colleagues here at Davis in vet medicine, particularly in veterinary medicine, where we have a strong group in toxicology. But also there are collaborators in environmental toxicology at Davis and people in land, air, water resources who do aquatic plant studies, and we'll get to those later on. So I list here a few of the things that we've looked at. So I've mentioned the fact that we've done the in vitro assays, which I'll describe in just a minute. We've looked at some of the physical aspects of these materials, such as zinc oxide solubility and how much zinc oxide solubility changes when we make these things as nanomaterials. And when we go to the nanoscale, one of the most important aspects of that is that we create enormous surface areas. So one might expect that solubility would tend to be much different for a nanoscale material per unit mass than it would be for a bulk material. That much greater surface area is going to have an important impact on physical properties and also on interactions with living systems, because that interaction takes place at the surface. So the surface properties, things that are attached to the surface, and dissolution, all of those things relate to the large surface area that we create with a nanomaterial. Another issue is where these things go in living systems, and I will describe some work we have done, some new work that we have just finished, got results recently, on translocation. The word translocation refers to the movement of particles through organisms and their movement from the site of original exposure into perhaps different organs. And that's been a concern that people have looked at over a number of years using methods which have some problems that I hope our new approach might answer. Nanoparticle stability refers to another physical property, which is aggregation or agglomeration of particles. Left to themselves, nanomaterials will tend to aggregate. They will not persist forever. They won't persist forever as a nano individual particle, but eventually will aggregate or will be scavenged by other materials in the environment. So the stability of these materials depends very much on the surface charge on a particle, and that surface charge can be affected by adsorbed materials, such as proteins in a living system, or perhaps by humic material out there in the environment, and that will affect the stability and aggregation of the nanoparticle, which will again determine something, things like their transport through the environment. How far, where will they get to? Are they removed because they are now aggregated into a larger particle? Will they sediment and not persist in in water? Finally, I'm going to give you an example of an application of these materials, which actually we discovered by serendipity, but it's an example of a good application of some of the nanoscale materials that we've been looking at, and the application there is arsenic remediation from water, and I'll show you that we have a material that actually has some favorable properties compared to the stuff that's currently being used for arsenic remediation. So let's move to slide number 11. And slide number 11 raises the question of composition. It was thought for some time that composition may not have been important, that all nanomaterials may be toxic, and that would be our only concern. But I want to point out on this slide that surface property of nanometal oxides, at least, is significantly determined by composition. And here I show you a quantity called the pH at the isoelectric point. This is the pH of the suspension in which particles are suspended, at which we have zero surface charge, and that pH varies significantly with different metal oxides. If we look at the outlier there, silica, that is only has a negative charge at very low pH and has a positive charge at everything else. If we look at all the others, they are significantly higher pHs at the isoelectric point. So zinc being having an isoelectric point at fairly high pH. So that surface charge, as we'll see in a minute, determines what gets absorbed to particles, and that adsorbed material is very important in determining uptake and fate and transport in the environment. So composition here is important. You see iron oxide actually in the middle there, and that pH 7 indicates it has very little surface charge. That leads to issues of stability, and so iron oxide has typically been a very difficult material for people to study in in vitro toxicology assays, because it very quickly aggregates, and it's very hard to deliver an individual nanoparticle of iron oxide in an in vitro assay because of that zero surface charge and rapid aggregation into larger agglomerates. Let's move to slide number 12. So here we have a look at, again, the same issue of, in this case, we're talking about attachment of proteins, and this slide just illustrates that we have different zeta potentials or surface charge for different materials. There's triangles indicating gamma phase Fe2O3, which is a very common material, ubiquitous out there in the environment, which is positive at low pH and becomes negative at higher pH. If we add a little bit of silica in there, we shift that isoelectric point. Like we said earlier, the silica oxide has a very low low pH at its isoelectric point. So the surface charges are changing. The paper I refer to here looked at the issue of PSA, protein absorption, to these materials. Like many proteins, PSA has different charge domains. That is, it has positive and negative domains in the molecule, and that molecule attaches to the nanoparticle in different ways depending on the surface charge of the material. So the BSA layer that gets absorbed to the nanoparticle is quite different depending on the composition of the particle. We call that a protein corona, and it's that protein corona which ultimately a cell membrane sees and reacts to, and the reaction will determine uptake of the particle into the cell. That surface corona may also determine translocation, movement of that nanomaterial into other parts of the body. So people believe that the protein corona is a very significant aspect of nanomaterials interacting with the living environment, and that surface charge and composition is very important in determining the nature of the protein corona. Let's move to slide 13. So slide 13, again, the same question, is composition important? And that is a question then we've addressed in our studies here at Davis by looking at a number of metal oxide compositions with roughly the same size of particles generated in the same manner but with different compositions and delivered to human endothelial aortic cells with an in vitro assay. So we have cell cultures of these cells. These are the cells that line the aorta. The question of whether that exposure is significant is a little controversial. It depends on whether we get significant translocation from the lung into the circulatory system. And as I'll show you a little later, there is evidence that that does happen. So we have looked at these human endothelial aortic cells. We have measured dose to the cells, which again is a very difficult issue that comes up in these nanotoxicology experiments, measuring the dosimetry. So we've looked at dose using a very sensitive method, which is inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry. And we have, for our endpoint, looked at markers of inflammation. So our interest here is whether inflammation can be caused by these nanoparticles and whether that inflammation then could explain the epidemiological data indicating exposure to, in this case, ambient particles leading to a rise in cardiovascular disease and a bad outcome for compromised people, typically, who are exposed to ambient ultrafine particles. So markers of inflammation are a measure of whether this is causing an effect or not with PCR, and also then an immunoassay, ELISA, looks at proteins to confirm the presence or elevation of cytokines and other inflammatory markers. So we're looking at a range of metal oxides, similar sorts of properties, similar sizes, and whether the composition is important in toxicity. Next slide, please, to slide 14. Again, I stress surface area is very important in nanomaterials. It is one of the distinguishing characteristics of a nanomaterial, having a very large surface area. And our three materials that we've been interested in fact, Spheria, I note down the bottom, has also been included. The Health Effects Institute wanted us to look at Spheria because Spheria is used in vehicle catalysts and there's concern that that gets into the environment and may be inhaled. So we've actually looked at four of these metal oxides. Three of them I show you here. There's a nitrogen absorption technique, BET method, for looking at surface areas. And I'll just point out that iron oxide has the highest surface area. That arises, as we'll see in a second, when we look at the electron microscope image. That arises because of a large number of very small particles that are attached to larger particles. That gives a very high surface area. The zinc oxide, you'll note, is the smallest surface area at 20 square meters per gram. So just keep in mind that iron oxide is the highest, zinc oxide is the lowest surface area. One might expect a material with a higher surface area to have the most effect on cells. Let's go to slide number 15. Here are images of the iron oxide particles, and the arrows indicate these very small 5 nanometer particles, which are created through a mechanism I don't have time to explain, but they're piggybacking along on top of these larger hexagonal structures, the larger 50-60 nanometer particles. It's those really small ones that cause the large surface area. The particles are taken up by cells, as you see on the right-hand side of the figure. Those particles are encapsulated in a vesicle, which we believe to be an endosome or lysosome inside the cell. These vesicles in cells are, one might describe them as the garbage can of the cells. They are low pH environments. Protons are pumped into them by the cell, and they function as a garbage can that destroys foreign material. So these particles are being endocytosed, taken up into the vesicles, and find themselves in a relatively low pH environment. You can see inside that vesicle, which is pretty clearly defined, fairly obvious nanoparticles, which are, if you look closely, at high resolution, are consistent with the particles that we're delivering. So these particles are apparently not dissolving in that condition. We go to slide 16. We see a very different picture for zinc oxide. These zinc oxide whiskers that you see on the left, again, are being taken up. They're actually captured in the cell membrane. There's some there shown on the right-hand side with the dark arrows showing what we believe to be the zinc oxide on the outside of the cell. But they are taken up in a vesicle, V. Down the bottom, the star shows what appears to be some endocytosis taking place, some particles being captured by the cell. They end up in the vesicle at the top, V, where you see that the particles are not well defined and appear to be dissolving. That would be consistent with the behavior of zinc oxide at low pH. It is going to dissolve under these pH conditions in the cell. So solubility appears to be quite different with the zinc oxide compared to iron oxide. And the cell, as you can see, is not responding favorably. We move to slide 17, we see results for measures of inflammation due to exposure to our three materials, iron oxide, zinc oxide, and yttrium oxide. The iron oxide, fortunately for us, since this stuff is everywhere around us, appears to be fairly benign at high doses. These doses are unrealistically high compared to what an animal or a human would be exposed to by inhalation, and typically we push the concentrations higher to be able to see a result and get a measurable response in a reasonable time. The iron oxide at these very high concentrations appears to do nothing, so there is no measurable markers of inflammation. At the very highest concentrations, yttria elicits some response, but zinc oxide is very effective in eliciting this inflammatory response. So there is very definitely a role for composition here, and the metal oxide toxicity is different depending on the composition. And that, I think, we can relate in this case to solubility. The zinc oxide is not persisting as a nanomaterial in the cell. It is dissolving. It is giving the cell a dose of soluble zinc at very high levels, and that would appear to be resulting in the inflammatory response. Let's move to slide 18. So to sum that up, solubility is important in terms of composition. The zinc oxide is amphoteric. It is soluble at low pHs, which is what we would expect in particles taken up in a lysosome that's acidic. The ceria I didn't show in that figure, but again we found ceria was not particularly significant. It was just barely significant response at the very highest concentration. So ceria was not really much more effective than iron oxide, meaning that it was minimally effective in inducing any inflammation. So the composition of these four metal oxides gives rise to significantly different effects in living systems. Let's move to slide 19. Okay, zinc oxide, as we see, is important in terms of eliciting a response. The question then arises, does it stay as a nanoparticle in the environment or in an organism? Will it dissolve, and is soluble zinc the way things get exposed to zinc rather than as a particle? So we have looked at that issue and developed a technique to measure accurately zinc oxide solubility. We're not the first to do that, but we think this method has some advantages over current approaches. Our zinc oxide is synthesized by two different methods, either through an aerosol process using a flame or through a solution wet chemistry method, and we were interested in whether there's any difference in solubilities of those two materials, since they do appear under an electron microscope to have somewhat different morphology. But XRD, X-ray diffraction, results down the bottom indicate basically the same crystal phase and same crystal structure. So the question was whether the solubility might be different between the materials. And if we go to slide 20, zinc oxide, as I mentioned before, has interesting properties. One of those is that it's a semiconductor and has an optical absorption down in the ultraviolet. That UV absorption can be measured in a spectrometer and will not be present if the zinc is dissolved. This is a zinc oxide absorption. When it dissolves, it disappears. So we can look at our wet chemistry materials, WC, or our flame synthesized ones, which are the black line on slide 20, and in a spectrometer measure absorbance, and the absorbance is essentially the same. The spectrum is essentially the same for both materials. So by measuring absorption and how it changes with time, we can get a measure of solubility of the zinc oxide. Go to slide 21. We see that the zinc oxide is minimally soluble in water. This is deionized water in this case. About a 20% decrease in absorbance, indicating 20% loss of solid material over about a 48-hour period. Our current work is looking at something a bit more interesting than that, which is to do the same experiments in biological material like cell growth medium, which is the stuff that we grow cells in, and the question there is whether zinc oxide solubility is significant in that medium because of the presence of proteins and other materials. So we can add different materials into the system and look at solubility in cell culture medium with serum present, and of course we could also do the same in simulated river water with humic material, etc., and see what the persistence of zinc oxide is using this UV absorption method. So that is one of the issues that's important in this whole area, is persistence of nanomaterials in the environment and in living systems. Let's go to slide 22, please. So slide 22 raises the next question that I introduced at the beginning, and that is the issue of translocation. Translocation refers to movement of nanomaterial through organisms from a site of exposure into different organs. And this is an issue that's been around for quite a while and has generated lots of controversy. It is a fundamental question because, at least in terms of inhalation, it raises the question of whether the effects that we see are due to a systemic effect arising from things happening in the lung, or is it arising directly in the organs that are exposed to the material after they translocate through the lung and go through the circulatory system to other places? They may even, when they're inhaled, travel along the olfactory nerve to the brain, and that has been demonstrated by Oberdurst's group. The picture on the right there is just a graphic demonstration of an unfortunate volunteer who was exposed to radioactive nanoparticles. And using radio imaging, you can see where they go. On the left, there's that green image of the lungs lighting up, obviously, with this radioactive stuff. And then eventually, a short time later, you can see them showing up throughout the body in different organs. That result was interesting at the time, but led to controversy because they were using radioactive label particles. And the thought now is that some of those labels come off the particles, and so we're not actually seeing the translocation of the nanomaterial, but actually just the label itself. So there is some question about the validity of those results. More recently, people have used other radioactive particles, but it's very hard to do inhalation studies with radioactive materials. And in addition, those materials are not typical of the metal oxides we're interested in. So our interest was to develop a new way of looking at translocation using more relevant metal oxide materials that present a surface which is typical of the nanomaterials that we are engineering these days, at least metal oxides, and using materials that are generated in the kinds of methods that are useful in industry, things like aerosol techniques. So that was our goal, and if we look at slide 23, we see that the method we used was to look at the fate of these things in the body without using radioactive traces that bring all of those problems that I mentioned. Our technique is to use lanthanides, or the rare earth elements. The rare earth elements include a range of elements like europium, terbium, dysprosium, etc., etc. So there's a wide range of them. These lanthanides added to an oxide nanoparticle are relatively non-toxic. The beauty of them is that there is no background. They're called rare earth elements because they're fairly rare, so there's not much out there in the environment. So they make a good tracer, and we can measure them very sensitively with that, again, ICP-MS, inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry. So they make an excellent tracer, and as a way of detecting translocation in an organism. So that has been our approach to address some of the problems that are out there with current studies of translocation using our materials. And currently we're trying to use flame-generated methods, aerosol methods, to generate atmospheres for whole-body inhalation studies, something that would be hard to do with radioactive traces. So that is our current goal with our friends in veterinary medicine. Let's go to slide number 24. So just a quick slide here showing we are using spray synthesis methods in a flame to generate these materials. We're doped with our lanthanides and producing nanoparticles. Slide 25 indicates the experiment. We're doing these mouse studies, and the current method we're using is instillation, meaning we put a bolus of material containing nanoparticles into a mouse at a location in the lung. And again, most things in this toxicology business are controversial, and instillation versus inhalation raises lots of questions. But nonetheless, it was a good place to start. So we're looking at lung instillation of the nanoparticles. After 24 hours, the animals are necropsied. We then look at the tissues that are digested in nitric acid and analyze with ICP-MS, all of which seems very simple. But actually, it's taken us 2 years to get this all right and do it correctly because there are lots of problems with contamination, keeping things clean, not getting cross-contamination of the lanthanide into other tissues, etc. So this has actually been a more difficult thing to do than I had expected at the beginning, but that's not unusual. So let's go to slide number 26. Slide number 26 looks at the results, the bar graph. Let's note, first of all, that's a log scale on the left, so we're looking at the lower numbers here, pretty small numbers, but these are the ICP-MS concentrations, parts per billion, of the lanthanide that we can detect, and we can get down with the ICP-MS to a hundred or a couple of hundred parts per trillion concentration of the lanthanide tag that we put in the particle. The main thing to notice is, first of all, the control is, like I said, a couple of hundred parts per trillion, so that's pretty low. That means we have good sensitivity, no background, and no contamination. Most of the stuff after 24 hours is still in the lungs. Interestingly, there's quite a bit that shows up in the feces, and that gets there because we have in our lungs something called the mucociliary escalator, which is our clearance mechanism. That's moving particles out of the lung, and then those particles being swallowed and ending up in the GI tract and excreted, so quite a bit does end up in the feces. But it's very important to notice here that we get significant measurable amounts in the heart, the liver and the spleen, and some in the kidney. Not very much in the blood, but it would appear that whatever gets into the blood is being scrubbed out in the other organs. So there are significant concentrations being translocated across the lung. This gives us a great way of looking at translocation, but also clearance, and that's something that excites our colleagues in biology. They now have a way of doing kinetics measurements of clearance rates of these materials from the lung with a quantitative measure. So this lanthanide tagging seems to be a pretty good way of getting a handle on those couple of questions of clearance and translocation. Let's move on to slide number 27. Another way we can look at all of this, and I'll mention this just very briefly, which is again where engineering can help toxicology. These particles can be made to have very useful optical properties. And one of the things we work on for biosensing is an upconverting phosphor. That means I can put near-infrared light into these particles and get a near-infrared emission or a visible emission coming out of them. And that is ideal for imaging in tissues. Because our tissues are transparent in the near-infrared spectrum, I can get light into and out of tissue and do optical imaging of where these particles are in detail. So that, if we look at slide 28, very quickly shows some spectra here of the particles we can engineer. There are, I don't want to sort of spend too much time on it, just on figure C, if we look at the bottom left corner, this is a material with thulium in it, with enhancement with a gold coating. The gold coating gives us a significant enhancement in emission, but we're exciting at 980 nanometers, and in figure number C, we're getting 800 nanometer light back out of it. That's called upconversion. So a low energy photon in a couple of those going in gives us a higher energy photon coming out, and that 800 nanometers will also get through tissues. So we're able to engineer particles for deposition and translocation studies making use of optical properties. Let's go to slide number 29. Stability and toxicity is this issue of aggregation kinetics, and we've spent quite a lot of time on looking at how rapidly things aggregate depending on their environment and their surface charge. We have found that serum, for example, when we're dealing with biological systems, can stabilize nanoparticles significantly, and that is all related to the surface charge. Zinc oxide, for example, is quite stable, and because of its significant surface charge, it adsorbs a lot more protein material that stabilizes the particles than iron oxide, which tends to aggregate much more quickly. We've also looked at flow, and those results I showed you earlier, looking at the zinc, iron oxide, and yttria in endothelial cells. That was all done under static conditions. And of course, if we have static conditions in the aorta, we have more problems than simply nanoparticle exposures. We, of course, have flow in those conditions, and flow can have an impact on the health of endothelial cells. So we've also looked at the impact of flow on inflammatory responses of endothelial aortic cells, and we've looked at the impact of flow on aggregation kinetics, and flow does tend to actually break up these aggregates, so the flow that's typical in our aorta will tend to disaggregate any particles that stick together. So we would expect probably if particles are translocating that they will persist as nanoscale materials throughout the circulatory system. And as we note at the bottom here, that flow does have an impact on cells' responses. And oscillatory flow is actually the worst flow in our system. It tends to exacerbate inflammatory responses, whereas a pulsatile flow is protective. So that flow pattern in our circulation is important. That may actually be relevant to why some people might be susceptible if they have underlying heart disease to exposure to these nanomaterials. If there's regions of the circulatory system, the aorta, where there's pathology changing the flow pattern, that may actually make them more susceptible to exposure. Let's move on to slide number 30. I think I've already covered this one somewhat, so I've mentioned that zinc oxide here adsorbs a lot more protein, iron oxide not very much, and that absorption, in this case of proteins, but it could be of material in the environment if these materials are in groundwater, for example. That absorption is quite different depending on the surface charge and composition of the particle. Let's move on to slide number 31. We have looked at toxicity in aquatic systems. So we've looked at duckweed, which is a favorite plant used by aquatic plant scientists. We've exposed the duckweed to copper oxide nanoparticles, again synthesized by our aerosol method. They've been added to the duckweed growing in water, and we have examined whether the nanophase copper oxide has a different effect to the equivalent soluble amount of copper added to solution to the duckweed. Let's go to slide 32. Very quickly, the copper oxide has to be characterized accurately for all of these studies, so we do these methods like particle sizing on the top left, transition electron microscopy on the right, and XID, X-ray diffraction, to characterize the crystal phase on the bottom left. So in all these toxicology studies, one has to begin by a careful characterization of the material. To slide 33. Stability is important, so aggregation and dissolution are important, and we've looked at all of those issues. I won't go into detail here, but our particles don't dissolve very much over 4 or 5 days, so they are persisting for a relatively long time without aggregating and dissolving in our duckweed experiment. Let's go to slide 34. And on slide 34, we have a picture here of the duckweed. The aquatic plant people look at something called the doubling time, which is the amount of time for the number of fronds or leaves of the duckweed to double. If you look at the little picture down at the bottom right corner, on the left-hand side is soluble copper. On the right-hand side is equivalent amounts of copper in the form of copper oxide. And you see, if you may be able to pick it out, but there is a difference there. The copper oxide nanoparticle on the right appears to have fewer fronds or leaves than the equivalent copper in the soluble form on the left. And if we go to slide 35, that indeed is the case. We look at the number of frond doublings as a function of days. We find, looking at the figure on the right, let's look at that one, we find the copper oxide of the lower curves there, the green cross and the brown circle. The doubling time there is significantly lower when the plant is exposed to copper in the form of the copper oxide nanoparticle versus equivalent dissolved copper. We have some evidence that the copper oxide particles are being accumulating underneath the fronds, so they are attaching to the fronds and roots. There is some preliminary evidence that there might be some uptake into the plant, but we are told by people who do electron microscopy on plants to be very, very careful about interpreting those things, so there is some uncertainty about that. But there's no doubt that we see a significant effect on plant growth when the plants are exposed to the copper oxide nanoparticle form of copper versus equivalent dissolved copper. Let's go to slide 36, please. So, there's the key results. Copper oxide nanoparticle does have an impact that you don't see with dissolved copper. There's also an impact we measured on chlorophyll content, another measure of aquatic plant health. And I did mention exposure through the ingestion route. It's interesting to note that apparently duckweed is used, I'm told by my plant people here, that it's used as a feed for chickens. And so there is a potential route for some aquatic plants to end up in animal food and therefore through the food chain in us. So there is there a potential ingestion exposure. So, quickly moving on to slide 37. I'm just going to go through this quickly because I'm running out of time, but we have looked at arsenic remediation using these nanomaterials, the iron oxide, and we found by serendipity, if we go to slide 38, that we were able to form interesting new nanomaterials by putting a magnetic field around our synthesis method. So by applying magnets to the place where we make the iron oxide particles, we form, in slide 39, we form these interesting long chains. Those long chains to us looked a little bit like a fiber which could be formed into perhaps a filter, and that filter might be used for remediating contaminated water. Let's go to slide 40. There's a close-up of some of our chains and the blown-up picture on the right of the little iron oxide crystals that make up the chain. Let's go to 41, slide 41. So they look like little fibers. They can catch them and they make this fibrous looking material. So on slide 42, we have looked with our colleagues in civil engineering with Tom Young and his student at the issue of arsenic absorption from water and how effective these materials are. And we can synthesize a range of different oxidation states of iron. So we can go from iron 2 to mixed oxide, iron 2, iron 3, something like magnemite. And we hypothesize that they may have different absorption efficiencies for arsenic. There is a commercial material out there that's being used now for arsenic absorption. That is bioxide, which is a very high surface area iron material. It's a goethite phase of iron oxide. That's being sold, and we have a comparison here of our materials, three or four different flame conditions making different iron oxides compared to the bioxide. If you look at the bottom right-hand figure, that is very high concentrations of arsenic. The left-hand portion of that is blown up into the upper left figure. That shows what's happening at very low concentrations. The bioxide, our benchmark, are the red diamonds, and our top materials there behave significantly better at very low concentrations. They're still very effective and perhaps a factor of two or maybe even three sometimes better than the commercial material. It appears that that results from surface charge, and that surface charge is pretty important in determining absorption of some of these anionic materials like the arsenic. So that was interesting. That was something we found by serendipity that indicates a useful application of some of the nanoscale materials that we've been looking at from the toxicology point of view, but there are also interesting potential applications. And one can ask whether all that has to do with surface area. If we look at slide 43, we can normalize things by surface area. And on that basis, we come out significantly better than the bioxide material. So for the same surface area, these modified oxidation state iron oxides are very effective. Let's go to slide 44, which leads us to Don. So to summarize, we have concluded that composition is really very important in determining toxicity of the metal oxides. That surface charge is one of the most important properties, and that will determine uptake by cells. It will determine phase and transport in the environment, and that is governed ultimately by composition. The morphology is not something I've talked much about here, but it's likely also that morphology will be important in determining not just surface area, which it will play a role in, but may also affect the uptake by cells and potential toxicity. The real problem is predicting these things because there are so many compositions, so many morphologies, that being able to say what any given new material might do is very difficult, and that really is why we have a problem in regulating and determining how to handle these new materials. So with that, I'll leave it, and I don't know if we have time for questions. I'll leave that to Sarah. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Kennedy. And thanks also for providing a nice segue into the next portion of our talk, moving from your focus on nanotechnology implications into the next part, which will be applications. I would like to let people know that Dr. Kennedy will have to leave the call a bit early, so if you have a question for him now, please ask it before he has to leave to teach. And if you are on the phone, then just take it off mute by pressing star 7, state your name and organization, and ask your question, and then when you're done, you can remute by pressing star 6. In the meantime, we did have one question come in from online, and it's just a simple one, I think, referring to your studies with the aortic endothelial cells. Were those a cell line or were those primary cells?
Those were cell lines.
Okay.
And I forget which passage they were, but they were cell lines.
Okay. Did anyone on the phone have any questions for Dr. Kennedy?
Yeah, this is Dalibor Bresnan from Health Canada. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hello.
Okay, hello. I had a question about some of your early slides where you mentioned that the particles are taken up by cells into lysosomes, and they are potentially dissolving in these lysosomes due to the low pH. So I just wanted to know if you're sure that these are lysosomes, or could they be actually different types of vesicles like, you know, endosomes or caveolae or something like that. So I was just wondering if you've actually checked with some specific lysosomal markers to make sure that these are lysosomes.
No, it's a good question. The answer is no, we haven't checked with particular markers. There are dyes and a number of ways of looking at whether these are lysosomes. That isn't something we have done. One of the things I was interested in, never got around to doing, was actually creating a nanoparticle that has incorporated in it a pH-sensitive dye. And so one could measure locally the pH around the particle. That ended up being a little bit more tricky than I had expected, but it is possible. One can put two dyes in a particle, and by looking at the ratio of fluorescence, get a measurement of the local pH. But, of course, biologists have got other ways of staining and looking at that. So, strictly speaking, that was speculative. That is a hypothesis that these things are lysosomes. I don't currently have a definitive proof that that's what it is.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think with that, we'll probably move on to Dr. Lucas's presentation. And if anyone does have any more additional questions for Dr. Kennedy, you can contact him after the seminar via email. And again, his email address is available on the additional resources page. Thank you again, Dr. Kennedy.
Thank you.
With that, we'll move on to Dr. Donald Lucas. Donald Lucas is a staff scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and a professional researcher in the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley. He received his BS in chemistry from the Illinois Institute of Technology and a PhD in physical chemistry from UC Berkeley. He has developed methods to measure chlorinated hydrocarbons, metals, and particles in combustion systems, and is currently using engineered nanoparticles to measure metals such as lead and arsenic in the environment. In addition to work funded by the NIEHS Superfund Research Program, he has performed research funded by the Western States Petroleum Association, Texaco, and Chevron, as well as the DOE, U.S. EPA, the California Air Resources Board, and the California EPA. He was an author on the SB 521 report to the Governor of California that recommended removing MTBE from gasoline and worked with California EPA to develop a multimedia review for pollutants. In addition to his research interests, he was Deputy Director of the EH&S Division at Lawrence Berkeley and chaired the lab safety review and laser safety committees. With that, I'll introduce Donald Lucas and his presentation on nanomaterials as environmental sensors. Thank you, Dr. Lucas.
You're welcome. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. Okay. Well, welcome, and thank everyone, and good afternoon for those on the East Coast and still morning here on the West Coast. So I wanted to start out by my introductory slide is slide number 44, and it's a picture of from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. I'd like to start with this because a lot of people get us confused with the larger Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, including people in Berkeley. So what you're looking at is a picture from the laboratory at night looking out over San Francisco Bay towards San Francisco and the Golden Gate. We are right above the University of California Berkeley campus, so it's pretty easy to get from one place to another, but we have better views up where we're at. If you move over to slide 45, a little introduction to the National Laboratory. We were the first national laboratory in the U.S. and actually in the world, and we're the home of big science. Well, E.O. Lawrence had his cyclotrons and his atom smashers, and they got too big to be located on campus, and they took them up the hill to set up a laboratory there. One of the claims to fame of the laboratory is that we are the home of discovery of elements. We've discovered 14 different elements, including elements such as californium and berkelium, lawrencium, and seaborgium, named after our sites and for people who've worked here. The laboratory is a non-classified laboratory. We're a general-purpose lab. We have about 4,000 people, so it's a real asset to have both the laboratory and UC Berkeley in the same place. If we move on to slide 46, I just wanted to emphasize that nanoparticles are everywhere, just like Dr. Kennedy was talking about how they're getting into the environment. They're being used in a lot of materials. In fact, one of the things I bought for my daughter, she's a softball player, I bought her a bat, and it contained carbon nanoparticles. And I'm not sure what they do to the bat, but I know it just made the price go up $70 over the non-carbon nanomaterials. But the thing to notice is that you can make a lot of different types of nanomaterials, different shapes, different sizes, and as most of you probably are aware, it's the unique properties of the different size materials that make them very interesting. And so what we're trying to do is use these materials to see if we can make better sensors. If you move on to the next slide, 47, not only have we been making engineered nanoparticles recently, in the last 15 or 20 years, but if you go back to ancient times, this is a picture of a stained glass window in Europe. Actually, it was discovered in the Romans. They were using colloids, gold colloids. And so it's not necessarily new. In fact, if you talk to a colloid chemist, they kind of laugh when they say, you know, engineered nanoparticles are a new thing. We're able to control the shape and size better, but we've been using them for a while. So some of the colors that you see in the stained glass windows are due to gold nanoparticles. Moving on to slide 48, and this is a modern version of it, we have researchers at the Berkeley lab who are using nanocrystals that are placed on windows, and they're electrochromatic, and so you can change the color, the light intensity that gets through the window shade by just changing the voltage on it through the semiconductor nanoparticles on the windows. If you move to slide 49, Dr. Kennedy mentioned, I want to mention that humans have been exposed to nanoparticles for millennia. So part of our work has been to look at indoor air pollution caused by cooking. So on the upper right picture is a picture of a woman cooking in rural China, and they use indoor cooking with no vents, and they use local coal. And we duplicated some of these experiments using the coal that they used. What was interesting is that there's a wide variation in the amount of lung cancer that these women have. They don't smoke, but because of the high exposures they have to particles from cooking indoors, unvented, about a billion people in the world are still cooking this way using very primitive fuels and very primitive methods. So we know they've been around for a long time. If you go to slide 50, one of the things we found in some of these coal samples was that there were nanoparticles, what are called microfibrous quartz in soot emissions. And if you look at the picture on the right, you can see it looks like a lot like an asbestos particle. So we suspect that there are some of these issues that we still don't understand. One of the problems, as mentioned in the previous talk, was that we really still don't understand what causes the health effects. We certainly don't know what causes the health effects from very complex particles, including those from combustion. Moving on to slide 51, now we'll move into what I want to talk about. Some of the work we've been doing under the Superfund research program is to try to get detectors using engineered nanomaterials. So we know that you can make metal detection pretty reliably. There's a lot of methods out there. There's a lot of people working on it. First of all, I want to say we're not the only ones working on it. There's a huge number of researchers and research groups that are looking for methods to measure things, including environmental samples. So our goal was to try to find cheap, reusable, simple methods to detect metals in environmental samples. Part of the reason was not just to reduce the cost. In the U.S., for instance, in other developed countries, there are usually very good methods. They're very reliable methods, and the testing is done already on water samples and air samples. So we know where the pollution sources are. It's difficult to reduce them sometimes, but we don't often have huge amounts of unknown or undetected pollution. At least we like to think we don't. However, in the developing world, there's places where they really don't make a lot of measurements, and we would like to come up with a better method that could possibly be used in developing countries for people who really want to test the water when they're drilling wells or taking water out of a local pond, and they may not really know what's in there. So the other thing we want to do when you're trying to make a sensor is to try to get a high sensitivity and selectivity with speciation. So that's the holy grail. So if you're measuring arsenic, you don't want just the total arsenic concentration, but you'd really like to know what's the ionic state and actually what is the total speciation of it. So that would be a nice thing to have. So the idea is to develop something like a pH paper for metals. So you can dip it into your water or wave it around in the air if it changed color. It's a simple way of detecting these. So as I said, a lot of people have been doing this, and when I was doing some background research on what people were doing with engineered nanoparticles as sensors. There's a lot of research papers on there, but there aren't many practical sensors out there yet. And so I was looking at it, and it just so happened that the Department of Energy and the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab was developing a new program to help people go from the laboratory out in the real world. And so they have a new system. Other universities have these tech transfer and things like that. But it's still a hard problem to get things out of the laboratory into the real world. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that at the end, some of the issues involved there. Moving on to slide 52, we're going to talk about the mercury sensor we've been working on using gold nanoparticles. Most of you are probably aware that the mercury cycle involves emissions mainly from coal power plants, and you'll have emissions in the micrograms per cubic meter to the milligrams per cubic meter. It's widespread, easily dispersed in the atmosphere. It gets into the food chain. It becomes methylated up the food chain. We take it in, get an exposure to the mercury, mainly through eating fish. But in some cases, there's issues of what are the mercury concentrations when you're close to a power plant. So while we're trying to do this, we already knew that people could measure mercury with gold. It's very easy to amalgamate it. In fact, there's commercial methods that are using gold now to not only pre-concentrate so that you can measure very low concentrations of mercury, but actually go out into the field. The sensors may be not as sensitive as you'd like, so one of the questions is there a way we could go from a gold film detector to an engineered nanoparticle gold to see if we could improve the sensitivity? So what is different about the gold nanoparticles as opposed to the bulk is shown on the next slide, slide 53. So nanoparticles change color depending on their composition, shape, and size. So the top curve is an absorption curve in the visible for spheres of gold nanoparticles. And if you notice the picture on the right, it's sort of a reddish color. And that's not... It is gold, and that concentration is about 10 parts per million of gold in water, equivalent in these small nanospheres. And you can see that it's definitely not gold color. You know, it's not the yellow that you normally see. If you look down below, there is a nano rod of gold, and you can see that the color is quite different than even the spheres. And so what happens is that the conduction electrons on the surface of these particles are localized on the surface, and it's called the localized surface plasmon resonance. So because the particle's small enough, the electrons don't have enough room to oscillate the way they would do in the bulk metal. And by changing the size and the shape of the nanoparticles, you can actually change where the absorption takes place. And in the case of the sphere, you'll get one peak that depends on the size of the nanoparticle. In the case of a rod, you'll get two peaks. One is in the long direction, so there's a plasmon resonance in the longitudinal direction, and in the radial direction. And these two peaks will depend on the size and the aspect ratio of the particle that you're using. Moving on to slide 54, the simple way to make a measurement of mercury with gold is to take gold particles, expose them to mercury. The mercury adsorbs into the gold particle, changes the color. So you can see a shift in the surface plasmon resonance when the mercury bonds to the isolated gold particles. And it turns out you can make shifts, measure shifts, when a few mercury atoms in a single nanoparticle are incorporated. So the picture on the top shows what we were trying to do is to not have it in solution. You can get gold solution, and this works quite well, but keep the particles isolated. So to make the particles isolate on a surface, you take a silicon surface, you do a little chemistry on it, you can attach the gold particles so that they don't interact. Because as Ian was saying before, that one of the problems with gold nanoparticles, or most nanoparticles in general, unless you treat them properly or keep them isolated, they tend to aggregate and change color and actually will precipitate very quickly. So what we do is we stick them on a silicon wafer and attach the gold nanoparticles and expose them to the mercury either in the vapor or in the aqueous phase. Moving on to the next slide. This also isn't really a new thing. So one of the first things we did was to purchase some over-the-counter colloidal gold solution. We did some of our first experiments using these because you could buy them cheap. You know, you didn't have to worry about making the gold nanoparticles. This is a food supplement, so you can go to the health food store and buy it. I think a bottle is about $30 or $40 a pint. You can buy it in bulk if you want. The claim is that these are 3.2 nanometer gold particles. We actually measured them. I think they're a little bigger than that. They claim they're totally non-toxic to humans, but they're good for curing whatever ails you. The recommended dose is 1 tablespoon a day, but power users can take 6 to 8. And I'm not really sure what a power user is, but nobody in my laboratory has had the nerve to drink this, mainly because we're not supposed to be ingesting the experiments we're dealing with in the laboratory. But it's interesting that you can buy not only colloidal gold, but colloidal silver, platinum, copper, so you can go out and buy this stuff if you want and do your own experiments. So moving on to the slide 56, one of the things we want to do is come up with a way of sensing it, because you could detect the gold in the solution, but that's really hard to bubble the liquid through, or if you have a water solution where it's not transparent, you know, it's muddy or turbulent, you would like to get a way to get the light in and out so you can measure the change in the absorption spectrum when the gold is exposed to the mercury. So what we use is called an evanescent wave technique. This has to do with fiber optics. So when you shine a fiber optic down, when you shine light through a fiber optic and it hits the water-glass interface, you what get typically is known as total internal reflection. And that's the reason why you can propagate light down this fiber for kilometers, and it's used in telecommunications. However, it's not exactly a perfect total internal reflection. Some of the light wave actually leaks out into the second part outside the fiber, and it can actually be measured. You can measure the interaction of that light with the material out there. So if you move on to slide 57, you see that this kind of sensor has been used. So if you look at the pink U-shaped on the side, sort of on the right side of the slide, what you do is you take a spectrometer, you shine light through a fiber, you take off the coating of the fiber and bend it, and then you can put material on the bent part of the fiber. The evanescent wave will interact with things that are stuck on the surface, and if those materials change either by absorption of gold or mercury into a particle, or in this case, this was developed for a biological sensor, so it can detect different materials because the material that's on the surface of the probe now is changing a little bit, and the light that goes through and can actually detect these. Moving on to slide 58, what we did was take a fiber optic, again, just bend it, put the gold nanoparticles on there so that they're isolated, and what you have on the lower left is the peak location versus time. And you can see that we're measuring a shift, in this case, of about 10 nanometers, which is fairly easy to do with equipment that isn't that expensive these days. We can measure shifts up to 20 nanometers when we can track it with a 0.2 nanometer wavelength and millisecond time resolution. On the right is a picture of the shift in nanometers per minute versus concentration. We found that it's a fairly linear. We're still working on this, so the students are still hard at work trying to improve the data here. But the idea is that you can make a sensor that's fairly stable, can be inserted into water or into air, and can detect the mercury in the elemental form. However, when you do this, moving on to slide 59 now, when we coat the nanoparticles onto a fiber, we really can't control the density and the agglomeration very well. We know that it's not just single particles that are lined up at a certain distance apart. You'll get some agglomeration, so you'll have some dimers, some trimers, some particles that are close to each other, and they probably are interacting but not forming a dimer. And what we want to know is, what is the best particle to use? So if you had to get a single particle of a uniform size and shape, what would be the best for detection? Because normally when you make nanoparticles, you get a range of sizes, a range of aspect ratios, et cetera. So the idea is to take isolated gold nanorods, look at their spectrum, and see if we can learn something about how they act as individual particles rather than as a bulk. Moving on to slide 60, what you have on the left is a dark field image of single of gold nanorods. And what this shows is sort of a picture of the nanorods that are on a grid. So it looks like a star map, what we call it. So the idea is that we know that each spot of light is either a gold nanorod or a dimer or a trimer or, in some cases, a blob. So we know that it's not a uniform composition. They're not uniformly distributed. But we want to be able to say, can we take this and figure out what's happening to one particular nanorod? The spectrum on the right, you can actually zero in on a particular nanorod and find it on this, and you can get a spectrum. So we know we can do that. The question is, can we take that sample, put it in our microscope, get a picture and a spectrum, take it out, put it into a mercury exposure chamber, and then put it back in the instrument so that we can detect changes in the gold nanorod. But we want to go back to the same nanoparticle. Remember, these nanoparticles are on the order of 30 nanometers long. So you're looking for a single 30 nanometer long nanorod in this star field. So what we do is, moving on to slide 61, you can actually sort of map out where it is. And if you look at the scale here, you can see that it's in microns on both the X and Y axis. So what we're looking at is an area about the size of the width of a human hair. And we can see hundreds of particles in there, and we just number them to see the ones that are interesting, and that has a pattern. What we can do then is actually go back and look for the same pattern and go back to the same particle. So what you can do by moving on to slide 62 is start expanding the magnification to locate these gold nanorods, and here we're up to 4,000 magnification. You start to see individual particles. Moving on to slide 63, we're up to about 30,000 magnification, and there you can actually see the individual particles. So we're able to locate these particles, the same particle going back to it time and time again. So what we're really looking at is the individual particle and how it interacts with the mercury. If you move on to slide 64, this is a combination of the two. So one of the things we had to prove was that we were still looking at the same particle, and it was sensitive to the differences in the particle size, and particularly the aspect ratio. So the spectrum on the right shows the absorption peak, and depending on the aspect ratio, we know there's a relationship there, and so we're pretty sure we can go back to the same particle and identify it. If you move on to slide 65, here's the thing we found. So we found this one nanoparticle, this one nanorod. We exposed it to a high concentration of mercury. We saw a shift in the peak of about 3.5 nanometers. And no matter how much we exposed this individual nanorod to mercury, it didn't shift any more than 3.5 nanometers. What's also interesting, if you look at the picture, is that the shape didn't change. So there was some work done in the literature that suggested when the gold is amalgamated with the mercury, that the nanorod would change size. In fact, it would start to become more spherical. Well, we found no change in the size or the aspect ratio at all. We also did some X-ray dispersive work to find the composition, how much mercury was on the particle, and we found it to be about 1.5%. So it looks like there's a limit as to how much gold you can put on to one of these very small nanorods. If you move to slide 66, the number's hidden there, but it's comparing a model that we developed using what would the absorption peak be for a single gold nanorod versus a single mercury nanoparticle of the same size. And by doing that, we expect to see a linear shift depending on the mercury. And in this case, the model predicts that the shift would be about would give about a 1% mercury for a 3-nanometer shift. So we have a model and the measurements that agree that we're really limiting the concentration of the mercury to about 1 to 2%. And this is an interesting point because we know we can get bigger shifts when we have more than isolated nanorods around. So for our evanescent wave sensor, we saw shifts up to 20 nanometers, and indicating there's more mercury that's being absorbed by the rods. And what we think is it's not an isolated nanoparticle that's producing that, but by particles that are close together. This has implications in being able to trap gold, so, or trap mercury. So if you're trying to remove mercury from a waste stream or from a power plant, you could use gold, but it's very expensive. One of the ideas is to make it very widely dispersed, maybe nanoparticles in very thin layers. But if you have it too isolated as single nanorods, you're only going to collect 1.5% by weight. But if you have dimers or things like that, you might be able to collect as much as 10 times more. So moving on to slide 67, the significance of our gold sensing is we've shown that individual gold nanorods can detect mercury at 10 micrograms per cubic meters in air. So we're measuring already what would be coming out of a coal power plant stack. The shift of 3 nanometers on a single nanorod, which we can measure, corresponds to 4 attograms. So that's 4 × 10⁻¹⁸ grams of absorbed mercury. The nanoparticles collect mercury as well as the bulk gold. And what we've been doing recently is looking at regeneration. So one of the problems with the nanorods is they're not only harder to make, but what we found is that the isolated ones don't work any different than the spheres. So we're going back to spheres, because one of the nice things about the spheres is you can gently heat them, and the gold comes, or the mercury comes off the gold, and the sphere doesn't change. So it actually goes back to the original surface plasmon resonance that was had, that was there before the mercury was exposed. So the idea that you could use the same sensor over and over again is appealing. Let's move on to slide 68. This is some work done by Peidong Yang, a professor at UC Berkeley, who's part of our Superfund research program. He's focusing on sensing arsenic using engineered silver nanoparticles. Arsenic is a real problem in water, groundwater, and particularly, again, in developing countries, but also in some developed countries, including Taiwan, China, and the U.S. It can definitely has health effects that you can read about there. The idea is that 10 part per billion is the WHO guideline for the maximum arsenic concentration in the water. And again, we do have lab-based methods that can detect these concentration of arsenic, but what we would like to do is be able to do on-site detection and have this available for developing countries. For instance, one of the things that happened in China and especially in India was that the UN went in there and provided money to drill wells to so people would not have to drink ground or surface water that was contaminated. It just had biological impurities. However, the water that they were getting from the well, while it looked very clean, actually had high concentration of arsenic, and they didn't find this out until they actually saw certain health effects. So the idea is maybe we could have a sensor that we could use for that. If you move on to slide 69, it turns out not to be just in developing countries that people worry about arsenic. This was a story that broke about 2 weeks ago on the television show of Dr. Oz. And this was a story, the AP medical writer, because he basically took apple juice and they made some measurements on it and found arsenic in there. And if you read it in the bottom, arsenic and apple juice fed to babies, and it probably came from China. What was interesting is that they used an inappropriate method. They were measuring the total arsenic concentration, and the toxicity of arsenic depends on the form it's in. So it was a very interesting problem in trying to convey this to the public, because not only do you have organic arsenic versus inorganic arsenic from the chemical standpoint, but apple juice tends to be divided into organic apple juice versus non-organic apple juice. And so people who are concerned about health tend to think of organic as meaning it's grown and processed in an organic way, not in terms of the concentration of an ion versus the concentration of a different species, an organic metal species. So it's a very interesting thing. So I wish we had a detector now. Probably we could have sold a million of them to people who were worried about the arsenic concentrations in their apple juice. Turns out I don't think it's a real problem, and I think they backed up a little bit on this. But it just points out that there are cases where these sort of concerns and the measurements to do them need to be fully explained and understood to get the right answer. So what Peidong Yang and his students do is he's a master at making different shapes. And not only does he make spheres and rods, but he'll make octagons and tetrahedrons and cubes and etched cubes. So by changing the chemistry, you can get all these wonderful shapes, which, because of the size of the particles, have different absorption characteristics. He also uses a technique called surface-enhanced Raman spectroscopy, which I'll show in the slides coming up, to make measurements. And what they're using is the points on these nanoparticles, the edges and the points, because there you have a very high electric field, which seems to enhance the surface, the Raman spectrum, and I'll be showing you some pictures there. So if we move on to slide 71, one of the other interesting things he's able to do is make large area nanoparticle films using a technique called Langer-Blodgett formation. So if you look at the top cartoon parts, what you do is you take a Teflon trough, you fill it with water, you drop in a little bit of the nanomaterial and organic material in a solvent. The nanoparticles spread out over the surface of the water, and they can form a nanolayer or a monolayer or even the submonolayers. And then there's a barrier, and you can control the surface tension on there and actually push the nanoparticles together so you can control the concentration of the nanoparticles on the surface of this liquid. And then you can dip a substrate in, and if you withdraw the substrate at the same time you push the barrier to keep the surface tension the same, you can actually coat the nanoparticles onto large pieces of prepared substrates. And the idea is you can do things like a sheet of paper pretty easily, not a piece of paper, but a piece of glass the size of an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, which then you can cut into your sensors after you do that. The pictures on the bottom just show the change in the color when you increase the pressure going across. So it's the same material there, but it's just because the concentration and the nanoparticles start interacting with each other that you change the color. If you move on to slide 72, here's some pictures of the kinds of films that he can make. Again, the pictures themselves look to me fascinating, but he can do cubes and octahedrons and all sorts of, I think you can probably get him to make any shape you want. If you move on to slide 73, what he's doing then is taking a little bit of the silver nanoparticle film and putting it with a surface-enhanced Raman spectra and looking at, in this case, sodium hydrogen arsenate heptahydrate. So the idea is by looking at the Raman spectrum is a way to measure the vibration of the molecule. So in this case, you're looking at things like the arsenic-oxygen vibrational spectrum. What's nice about it, if you look at the concentration at the bottom, the little table there, you can see you can measure down to 0.1 parts per billion, and there's 550 molecules in the laser beam volume. So you can measure, again, very low concentrations that are the kind of concentrations that are seen in the environment. What's really exciting about his method, though, is shown on the next slide, which is slide 74, where you can actually see the speciation of the arsenic. So in this case, he's looking at arsenic in the +5 state in the oxygen vibration. So the peak is around 800 nanometers on the big graph, and if you look at the inset, is the prepared thing. So it's a spectrum of a known compound, where in the larger spectrum is actually done on the probe molecules in his nanoparticles. And you can see that the spectrum matches pretty well. So the idea is that not only can you make measurements of the arsenic concentration, but you can get some idea of what the speciation is. Let's move on to the last bit, of the talks, starting on slide 75. It's called the Valley of Death. This is not new. It's known to a lot of people in the research area, especially in those that are in the R&D, where they talk about the development part. So on your left, you have a great idea, and then there's this Valley of Death, which is called innovation, which is the hard part to get over before you get to the marketplace. So this is not new. It's been known by many companies. It's a really hard thing to overcome. Companies have a hard time overcoming this, and they're really specializing in getting products to the market. Most research universities and national laboratories aren't really equipped to develop products and have spin-offs. Some are really good. I give my colleagues a lot of credit for those who do that, but it's really hard to be not only the inventor, but the innovator and the marketer, and then, you know, running the company often require different skills, and it's a very difficult thing to do. It takes a lot of time. If you go over to slide 76, this is a slide from 97 and from Forbes magazine. I got this from our tech transfer group at the laboratory, and I found it very interesting because it shows how long it takes from the year from the invention till a significant part of the population owns it or is using it. You can see the automobile took forever. Televisions, you know, they sat around for 25 years before there was a significant market penetration. If you look over on the cell phone, even that, a cell phone, it took 10 years before the market penetration reached 20%. Of course, today, if you expand this, remember this was in 97, I think the ownership is probably 150% because it seems like everybody I know has at least two cell phones. But it takes a long time, and it's the time in between the invention and when you get it in the market that's a real problem. I'm going to use an example that I had where it was working with the oil companies and the EPA and the California Air Resources Board. So they knew this was to measure the emissions of hydrocarbons from heavy oil storage tanks. So this is really low tech. I'm going to change subject completely here. But the idea was that they used an old method, the Reed vapor pressure method, to measure oil vapor pressure from gasoline. Works great for that. They applied it to the heavy crudes that come out of places like Bakersfield. This is a picture of an oil tank in the fields in the Bakersfield, California area. Everybody knew the technique didn't work well, but because the levels were so low, it didn't really matter. It wasn't until the pressure to lower the emission standards and to improve the air quality in areas like this that they realized we need to come up with a new method to measure it properly. So if you move on to the next slide, it's called, I call it my Home Depot sampler. So we developed a method to come up with a way to go out in the oil fields and collect the method using parts that we bought at the hardware store. So instead of a $500 or a $2,000 piece of equipment, we were able to put these together for about $25 in parts and pieces. Which means we can make a lot of them, and we did it. The people wanted us in the EPA. It took many years. It took us about 5 years to get EPA approval. And they said, gee, why come we don't make this a test method that we could, you know, put out in the field and start marketing and everything? Well, part of it was that we realized there really wasn't a market for it. You didn't have a lot of people who needed something like this, and the funding that we had for it didn't really pay for the development. The idea was to develop a new method, but not to develop and innovate and come up with a method that could be applied to the marketing of such. So if you move on to slide 79, my takeaway message on here is that to make a successful widget out of an invention in the laboratory, you really need a good market. So I like to think of medical and consumer goods, not emission monitors. So the idea is that we probably could sell arsenic monitors for measuring things in apple juice because there's a million people who would be interested in that. But how many people would be interested in measuring mercury from their water supply now when they've already are somewhat confident that there is a good source? And in developing countries, people don't have the money to take that. So it can take a long time and a lot of money for the patents, the product developing, and the market. And research scientists may not make the best choice for moving forward. Most researchers that I know really want to do more research. They like to spend their time in the laboratory, and it's hard to get them to think outside the box. And again, finally, basic research grants don't normally cover development costs, and the time involved is quite different than is involved in most research projects. So on slide 80, I would like to thank my colleagues and coworkers, and especially the students who did all the work. And with that, I'd like to thank you also and hand it back to Sarah.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Dr. Lucas. And before we open the question and answer session to Dr. Lucas, I just wanted to make sure everyone is aware of the link page and the online feedback form. So if you click ahead to slide 81, there are links there for additional resources and the feedback form. These will stay with the seminar indefinitely so you can access it later. And again, these will be placed online in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you can access the slides again and hear the presentation as it was given today. I really would appreciate it if you would fill out the online feedback form, and we will look at those comments to try to continue to improve the content and delivery mechanism. If people want to go ahead and start asking questions, you can either type it in if you're coming to us online, or if you have a question on the phone, then you can take your phone off mute by pressing *7 and state your name and organization and ask your question. Well, you gave a great presentation, then I guess that's not leaving leaving anything open for people that they're unsure about. One thing that I was wondering about is with the following, the mapping the individual particles, I thought that was really fascinating. And is that something, is that new, or is that something, you know, like, that's something that's brand new that's coming out of your lab, is that correct?
Well, it's new in the sense, for us, because other people have done it for this sort of thing, but what we wanted to do is make sure that we could. The problem is it would be nice to put the mercury into the instrument, you know, the electron microscopes, but we don't own the microscopes, and they won't let us put in materials like mercury or arsenic into them.
Uh-huh.
So the idea that being able to take out a macroscopic slide, which is about a centimeter on a side, expose it, and then go back and find the same single nanoparticle that you started with is pretty interesting. And it just shows you how well, and again, we're not the first to do that, so it's that's not that exciting, but how well we can control where we're looking in some of these things.
Right, and do you think then that that would have any implications for any kind of tracking within a biological sample then, or right now are we just talking about, you know, a pure sample of mercury vapor, that sort of thing?
Well, we're just doing with the pure mercury to start with.
Mm-hmm.
What we're also have been looking at is ionic mercury, because what we can do is reduce the mercury plus two using solutions like sodium borohydrate back to elemental, and then by measuring the difference, we can not only get the total mercury, but then the ionic and the elemental. So that's our step, and then we really don't know if we can do anything with the organic mercury, mainly because the concentrations are so much less than the elemental and the ionic.
Okay. Did we have anyone else who wanted to ask a question on the phone? Okay, well, I guess everyone is feeling shy this time. So if there are no more questions, please remember that you can contact either of our presenters, Dr. Kennedy or Dr. Lucas, via email with any additional questions, and you can find their email address on the additional resources page. I'd like to thank both of our presenters, Dr. Kennedy and Dr. Lucas, for their time in preparing their presentation and for sharing it with us today. This will conclude today's presentation, and thank you all for your participation. Oh dear, we did just get a quick question. Dr. Lucas, are you still on the line? Nope, I guess not. Okay, thanks again.